Hi, I'm Jeff Stelling, and this is Football's Greatest. Today's guest worked with some of the greatest managers of all time. He later became a manager himself, with Coventry, Southampton, Celtic, Middlesbrough, and Scotland. He is Gordon Strachan.
He was the angriest man I've ever met in my life. I'd seen anger from different managers like Billy. This was non-stop aggression. Ron turned into a celebrity. You know, he'd be sitting at night with Leslie and you're watching the telly and Big Ron's there as Frank Sinatra. I think if you can manage Celtic or Rangers and come out sane at the end there, then you can go and manage anybody in the world, because that is where there is real stress.
So Gordon, you'll have been asked this a million times before, but I've got to ask you. We talk about managers.
Yeah.
And I think of, you know, Jock Steenbull, Shankly, Kenny Dalglish, Sir Alex, Walter Smith, you, Matt Busby, George Graham, Jim McLean, and on and on and on goes the list. And the one common denominator is that they're all Scots.
Yeah.
How does that happen?
We're all bad-tempered. We're driven. And we think the world's against us. It's a good starter. Because if you think about all these people you're talking about just now, I'll take myself out of it. They're all stubborn. They're all dogmatic. And people think that stubbornness is some sort of horrible trait. It's not. To keep your philosophies and your standards, you need a stubbornness. So Alex got it. That's what he does, you know. And you might be wrong 15% of the time, but if you're right 85% of the time, then you're going to be a successful manager. So they're all stubborn, dogmatic. And the ones you talked about earlier, with Steen, Shankly, Busby, Ferguson, there's not so much further. He was a disciple of the guys. They were all miners from a mining community where the team ethic was the be-all and end-all. And that's the same with Sir Alex. Alex took over for these guys, added a bit to it, obviously. And his thing was all about teamwork, looking after your teammates, family. That's how he worked. His petrol was anger, as you know. There's nothing wrong with that either. People again think that's a bad trait. It's no, you need anger. Funny enough, I see a lot of managers just now and they're past their sell-by date. They know themselves, really. They've lost the anger, they've lost the drive, but they're still persisting at it. Get out and do something else. Enjoy it. Don't waste anybody's time. So, yeah, it's an innocent group of people that you're talking about. Shankly, Steen was a big one, but Shankly. I remember he used to take, because I was always interested in football, and there was no football in these days. Like yesterday, I watched four games of football. I mean, seriously, what was I thinking about? But during the day, I watched four games of football. And the days when I was at Aberdeen, you had no games. You only had cup finals, maybe international games or European games, match of the day. And to watch games, you had to go locally. So Sir Alex knew I liked football, so he was only Alec at the time. He wasn't a sir at the time. There was all sorts of words to describe him, but he definitely wasn't a sir at that time. And he go, right, where do you go on the night? I went, do you fancy you got to see Brechin versus that? Ah, yeah. And I went with him. But then the car, he had a big old Mercedes and he had that 8-track thing. He used to stick it in there. And it was Shankly speaking. I'd have to listen to Shankly all the way down to Arbroath or Brechin and things like that and watch games. And so it was educational listening to Shankly and him at the same time. So you just imagine me, I'm sitting in the middle at 21, 22, listening to Shankly and Ferguson about football. So it was a great educate. So that's it. Sir Alex was, he was big into the guys, and that run through his coaching mantra or philosophy all the way through his football.
Did you learn anything from those Shankly tips?
They had two things. The Shankly tapes, which is fine, which is great, which was I knew most of it working as a team, and the way Shankly spoke was brilliant. It was a magical voice, Shankly. It was just draw you in. He also had another tape, Sir Alex, which he used to play in the bus called Glenn Daly singing. We got rid of that as a team. He still doesn't know to this day who chucked it out the window. This Glenn Daly live at some social club, somebody chucked it out the window. He was a small guy. And
he's sitting quite close to me.
Yeah, I recognise him over there. Yeah. So that went. That was his two tapes.
Brilliant. I mean, you were a captain of Dundee when you were 19. Does anything within being a captain help you become a manager?
No, because at 19 I was absolutely useless. I was horrific as a captain. Truly horrific. I modelled myself on Billy Bremner. I was a pathetic Billy Bremner. I wanted to go about bumping into people, growling at people, shouting at people. And I forgot to be a footballer. I literally forgot to be a footballer, so I was useless. Tommy Gemmell made me the captain. Tommy Gemmell, the Celtic Lisbon Lion. We had two Lisbon Lions there at the time. Matter of fact, there was three. I played with Jimmy Johnson as well. So three Lisbon Lions at Dundee at that point. And it was fantastic. Not because they made us any better, but they literally, we got retold the European 67 Cup final every day about how Jimmy did this and Tommy did that and Willie did this. And we would just stand back watching them recreate free kicks, crosses and everything. And we just stood there and were wondering when they've got to try and make us a wee bit better because we were useless.
And of course you went to Aberdeen.
Yeah.
Under Billy McNeil as well. Was he the same?
Billy was a wee bit different. No, Billy was different. It was John Clark as well. It was another one. So it was five of them. I had to deal with five of them. And that period. But what they did tell me, that character was a big thing in, as a footballer. And they're all characters. John Clark was probably the quietest, and the rest were all characters, big characters in their own right. I got my toenails taken out by the roots when I was a kid, when I was a captain. I was in hospital and I was in agony. Can you imagine getting your toenails taken out? But it was horrific. I had one of these big cages over my feet, and Tommy turned up with Willie Wallace. It's the only manager ever come to visit my hospital with a carry-out. Four bottles of wine and a dozen cans of lager. And I had to sit for the next 4 hours in agony, recreating the cup final again. There was another couple of quarter-finals chucked in and things like that. I had to say to the nurse after a while, could you give me something to put me to sleep because this is too much. She says, the pain. Say, no, just them two talking about the games I've been playing in. So, but it was all about characters. Then you say we went to Billy McNeil, who's a different sort of character. He was a different sort of character.
Mm. And it was at Aberdeen, obviously, that Sir Alex first managed you. Just Alex, as it was then. Was it obvious straight away that he was going to be something special?
He was the angriest man I've ever met in my life. I'd seen anger from different managers like Billy and David White, who was my first manager at Dundee. But this was non-stop aggression. I don't know if you call it bullying. Can you get away with bullying? It's funny enough, anybody who was underneath them never call it bullying. We call it getting pushed, driven, cajoled. Nobody ever mentioned the word bullying when we all got together. It was just driven to be the best you can be. And so we knew he was different. At the time, he had a problem because he kept referring to St Mirren, the St Mirren team that was playing with, talking about Tony Fitzpatrick, Billy Starr, people like that. And he was going, do us a favour. Again, make us better. So I think he realised after a couple of months, I better put that aside. And then you realise that you're dealing with something different here, because we all thought at this club we were kind of, what you call, I hate using this word, winners. You know, we weren't they. We were pathetic. It was like me being that pathetic Billy Bremner. And we thought we were competitors. No, we were narky. We didn't know the game. And he put us right in what winning is all about. Winning is everything. Winning is every part of your day, where you're training, where you're sleeping, where you're doing right, you're looking after your teammates, family. So we realised it was a different ball game, and if you wanted to be with them, you had to, you know, your whole lifestyle now had to be as a footballer. You know, and people talk about Arsene Wenger, about meals and things like that. He was doing that years ago at Aberdeen. We'd all have to sit together at lunchtime. Alcohol was banned during the week, and he would know exactly where everybody was. Trust me, he'd know exactly where everybody was. Golf, no golf, which I kind of, one of the things I learnt from him when I was a manager, no golf, because football players think that's good to go out and play golf. It's no. Because if I say to you, let's go and play 5 hours of golf, walk about hills, I'm doing hills, and you get back, you know, you're tired.
Yeah.
That can be used for training. That should be, every energy you have should be used for training. That was the kind of thing he changed. Where were you after? I went shopping with my wife. Why are we going shopping with her? I said, because she wants, no, no. You stay in the house, you rest, let her go shopping. all that kind of stuff. Everything was about rest, training, working as hard as you can. And I said to you, our mindset was you had to win games. Every game you played, you had to win. You know, even fitness-wise, he scared us into being fit. Literally scared us into being fit because we had a squad of about 15 players. Nobody got injured because we were scared. Because if you got injured, you went on Monday and said, listen, I've got a bit of sore ankle, can you train? Right, North Sea. That's where you went, the North Sea in January, snow and everything. You used to have to stand in the North Sea, whatever injury you had. And if he wasn't happy with the injury, you go down at night. He sends you down at night, 7 o'clock, and it's snowing. You've got your Sony Walkman on your thing, and you're freezing because the waves are coming in past your knees. Mrs. Strachan's in the Fiat 127 special because I can't drive. She's pregnant, and I'm in there trying to make myself fit for the game on Saturday. So on a Monday, anybody injured? No, no chance. Absolutely no chance. We're fine. Big holes in your ankle and your shin. So this whole thing was just professionalism. Yeah. That nobody's ever seen before.
So Scotland. He was ahead of his time, a bit like Wenger, yeah?
Miles ahead of his time with the food we used to get pasta and all the rest of it, stop the alcohol, all the rest. He did that, you know. There's things you get marginal gains now and all the rest of it, but what he went for was a majority gains. Super fit, doing everything right, working at your technique, working as a group, so we'd get the majority of things right. We're so caught up now in the marginal gains. But he got the majority gains right.
Would he listen to players? I mean, if you had a grievance or a suggestion, would he listen?
Absolutely not. No chance. It was somebody has tried, and me in particular, but it was a waste of time. As soon as I started the argument, I knew fine well that I wasn't going anywhere with this. I was getting it, you know. But the funny thing at the time is, it was like most people had it. I got it more than anybody else and probably deserved it more than anybody else. But we had a kind of, after it happened, we had this kind of group, you know, this group meeting where we all got together and we all kind of got round and empathised with each other. Oh, right, he's off his head, never mind. So we all felt better, but we never felt isolated. It was only me, because we've all been receiving end it. Only Willie Muller probably was the only one that never come on the receiving end it. But when you look back in it, because I spoke to him a couple of months ago, and he was talking about things he said and done. I said, listen, don't even think about worrying, because he's worried about one thing in particular. I said, don't even worry about it. I says, we're still laughing about it now. It's hilarious. You know, it wasn't hilarious at the time, but we think it's hilarious now. But we also think it's very special, because I think anybody in the football world would love to have been in the dressing room with Sir Alex Ferguson at half-time or full-time. I don't care who you are, journalist, player, physio, to be in that dressing room with that energy that he set off. There's only a few years had it.
What did he do at halftime then?
Well, it usually came for me. And I always knew when he was came for me, because Willie Muller was one side and I think it was Mark McGee was on the other side. And we all used to keep our heads down until they come in. And we're scared to look up. But then you see the shoes point at you and, oh dear, here it goes. So when the shoes pointed at you, the two guys on either side kind of crept away and left you on your own. So Willie would move to the right and Mark would move to the left and leave me on my own to be on the receiving end of this. Which was great, because all the guys went, the longer he spends on that wee fella, that he's not coming round to me. So I kind of took a bit, probably deserved a lot of it. But,
so this is a sort of early hairdryer, isn't it? You know?
Well, it started there.
What was it like to be on the receiving end of that then?
Well, you think about it now, you laugh about it, but at the time you think, oh no. And the problem was that he used to come so close to you that he couldn't see the players, but I could see the players, and they were at you, and I'm looking at them as he's raging at me, and they're in between laughing or saying, go and have a go at them. You know, I'm like, no, I'm frozen here in time. I can't do anything, because we really could at that point, if he disliked you, he could. You don't get a game. You don't get a game. But I said, I wouldn't have missed it for the world. Yeah. I worked with the best managers in the world, and he is the best. I apologise to all the other managers, but his record's phenomenal.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't have missed it for the world. As I say, he's still the same. Now, I met him a couple of months ago, and I was with Steve Archibald McLeish and Willie Muller, and he come up and smacked me in the head. And I went, oh, he went, what's that for? He said, get your hair cut. All right. And I'm actually 67 looking at my watch then. 6 o'clock, where can I get my hair cut? He still has his presence.
Brilliant.
You know?
I hope you're enjoying the show. We can't do it without you. If you're listening to us on your favourite podcast platform, please press follow to make sure we're in your feed every week. And we look a hugely successful time at Aberdeen, winning the league title, coming to the Cup Winners' Cup in a moment. Everybody wants to talk about the 82 final against Rangers in the Scottish Cup, and Sir Alex's reactions afterwards, is displeased, one way of putting it.
It was 83.
83, 82.
82, yeah. We beat Rangers 4-1, I think.
Yeah.
And funny enough, I knew at the time what was... Well, I knew after about 10 years what was up with him when he did that. But at the time, we found it very strange. Again, hilarious. But at the time, I was absolutely raging. Briefly, that he's went to the pitch after the game. I think I'd played about 60-odd games that year. Real Madrid 10 days previous, and just got beaten the league by a point or two Saturday previous. And we won 1-0. It was a horrible game. I mean, a horrible game. And we just scraped through. And we get in the dressing room, and I said to Archie Knox, because we were all knackered, we all knew it wasn't a good... I said to Archie Knox, could you possibly open that champagne? Because you didn't get water in these days after it. It just, whatever was going about. And Archie went, oh, no, you can't do that. I said, what's up? She says, oh, he's gone mad out there. He's gone absolutely, all right, okay. So we all sat there with our winner's medals in our hands, not a word said. McLeish come in, he got the man of the match. And he went, right, lads, well done, lads. And he said, what's up here? And I went, oh, he's gone bonkers out there. So cut a long story short, he's come in, he started screaming and shouting again. And not a word. And so this went on for ages. He had an argument with this one, had an argument with that one. What he did say, that there's only two people, you know, played in the game. McLeish and Miller, he was on the things. McLeish and Miller won it. McLeish and Miller won it. The rest were a bloody disgrace. A disgrace. We set standards club long ago. I've never got it. Right, okay, right. So he kept going on about this. And then, to be fair, it's funny now, because it's become a real character thing, this with McLeish and Miller. Because, you know, every time I meet Big Alec, you know, he speaks at the side of his mouth, have you got that winner's medal I made you? I went, no, I gave it away. So usually after you win a thing, going down Union Street in Aberdeen, you get the team bus and it's open top. So we just said, well, all you really need is a tandem for Wally and Alec to go down. So we actually thought about this year, and we've actually got a guy who did it, caricatures. It's these two on a tandem with the rest of the team clapping them down Union Street. It's a fantastic, fantastic thing. Yeah. So he went absolutely bonkers. And the wives who usually come to the games, because they were only wags for a day in the days. They were only wags. They were ordinary people in the days. So they got dressed up for it, because we used to disappear for 3 days, build up to the game, and they'd come down on the bus. And if you win, they're delighted because you're getting a three-piece suite with a bonus or something like that, or a decent holiday. But they were on the other bus. But he refused to allow them to come on because we were a disgrace. So you could see the wives as we were getting the bus. They were walking across, but the security guy stopped them. Went, no, you can't get on. And they days never had any phones. So you're waving it to them. And they're waving back. And they're going, what's... They can see them. They can see what they're going, what's wrong? He's a nutter. So whenever I never seen my wife for about 2 hours after, because I had to go back to St Andrews.
I mean, it's amazing, you know, especially in this day and age, to think of what that team achieved. I mean, winning the Cup Winners' Cup, beating Bayern on the way, you know, beating Real Madrid in the finals, astonishing. Yeah,
and then
really.
Going on to, you know, to beat the champions of Europe, Hamburg, over two legs.
Yeah.
Which is like, when you think about it now, it's a fantastic achievement. They were all Scottish, and the oldest people on the team were Willie Mullen and John McMaster at 27. So the oldest people on the team were 27. That is some going, you know.
Yeah.
But as I said, we were bullied into winning it and scared into winning it. There was nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
We were scared of losing. We were absolutely scared. People said, how do you just keep winning? I said, well, it wasn't so much of winning, we're just scared of losing. Again, by this force of nature and a group of people who were willing to to go a wee bit further than anybody else.
When it came to you leaving Aberdeen then, how did you manage to tell the force of nature that you wanted to leave? How scary was that?
Oh, I did tell them. But I'd asked for a transfer 2 years previous to this. And I was told, as a matter of fact, that McLeish was wanting to leave as well. So both of us, you know, we agreed that we'd go and ask him.
Together.
Okay. Right. As we were walking down the hall. But obviously, he must have known that there was something happening. Archie Knox must have got word that we were going to ask for a transfer. Because we'd been to the World Cup in 82, McLeish, myself. And we actually thought it was maybe time. I'd been there maybe nearly 5 years at that point. And so Big Alec, right, we'll go and see him. So we paced about for days. And then, can we get a meeting with the gaffer? Archie says, I'll speak to him. Right, see him tomorrow. So as we're going there, Big Alec went, you know what Big Alec's like? He says, I think you should go in first. I said, why is that? He says, well, you're the most experienced and you've been here longer. Da-da-da. You go in and I'll stand out here and I'll go in behind you. I went, aye, fine, good. Well, Muggins went, right, that's a good idea, Alec. Right, so in I go. And you could see he was waiting for me. Gaffer, I'd just like to say, da-da-da, I've been here 5 years. I think it's time that I'd like to move on and see something different, blah, blah, blah. And then it started. A tsunami of rage and this, that and everything. And it was screaming, shouting. And basically, I was told to go forth and multiply. And no chance. So that was asked for about 2 years previous. So screaming and shouting. And then I went outside, near McLeish. He's obviously heard this going on. And he's disappeared. Never seen him for another 2 days, and he stayed for another 15 years.
Brilliant. It's amazing, I mean, how often you and Alec Ferguson's careers would cross paths.
Yeah. 9.5 years we worked together, wow. Actually. Wow. So I really feel honoured to seriously honoured. You know, people say, well, it was a wee bit rough at times. Yes, it was rough at times. But if it wasn't for meeting him, I wouldn't be sitting here today with you.
Because that's at the time, was you—the time you're playing for Aberdeen, but you play for Scotland as well,
yeah.
Who are managed by another great man in Jock Steen.
Yeah.
How different were the two?
He just had this incredible presence. I think Jock was past his best in terms of the game. The game was changing just a wee bit because he had that group. It was just on the change. And I don't know if he still had the drive that he had. Because the game takes drive out of you. Trust me, there's only so much drive. You can ask all these people like Souness and Douglas and that. They'll tell you, and when the drive's gone, you've got to get out because it's no fair in everybody. But there's a point where you think you can still get it. I think Joke was at that stage. But Joke was... Everything was so simple with Joke. He said things that made sense. You know, you do it the day and you speak to people and you go, I've listened for 15 minutes and it's just jargon. It's cliches and jargon. He said something in a sentence that made sense and made you aware of what your job was, made you aware of what you're good at and what you should be doing. You know, I remember saying to John Work, we're finished, simply a group of people and all these wonderful stars around Souness, Douglas, Hanson, Archie Game and all that. And he said to John Work once, John, is it fair to say, son, if you're not scoring goals, you're no use to us? And John's face went red and we're all looking at him and he went, yeah, I suppose you're right. So that's what the kind of things he said, and sometimes it'd be a bit brutal. But it wasn't meant to be brutal. It was just telling you the truth and what you were good at. You had to be. He said that the same to me. If you're not passionate and making chances, son, you're not, you know, we can get it. Well, okay, fine. I did the same when we're playing Sweden, and it's one of the funniest things I've ever heard, but I was on the receiving end there, and I was sitting beside Kenny. I think Willie Miller was on the other side of me. And I'd scored against Sweden over there in the first game in the group. We won 1-0. And I'd been out with an injury for a long time. And I got back into the Scotland squad. Maybe back 3 weeks playing. And he's got me in the squad again. And the team meeting was a bit right, okay. And he was good. He knew the game brilliantly. So he's put up the Swedish team. And then he went, this guy here, no much of a player, hard, driven, and he's coming into man mark, you wee man. And my chest puffed out. I'm sitting beside Douglas Miller, hands in. My chest went like that. He says, but we've got a surprise for them. You're no playing. And you've got to look about going, oh, that's a good idea, Joe. That's great. Nobody's looking at me. They don't know what I was going to burst into tears, but that's the way it is. He had this incredible presence about him. And as I said, Sir Alex used to, matter of fact, he was at the 83 Cup final, the European Cup, Winners' Cup final, as a guest of Sir Alex, just to be there as a presence, which, again, that helped. There's no doubt about it.
Because obviously, I mean, at a domestic level, Jock had an absolutely unbelievable record. And internationally, was he a bit unlucky? I mean, I looked at that 1982 World Cup, you know, he had drawn in a group with Brazil and the Soviet Union, who were good at the time.
They were good at the time, yeah. New Zealand were the best, obviously. But the other ones, like Brazil, were just phenomenal. I have no idea how they didn't win that World Cup, because they, you know... Socrates in the middle of the park, Cerezo, Falcao, Junior at left back, Zico. It was an incredible team, and they were different specimens for us. I tried to explain that years ago in Scottish football, that, and some professor said, "Oh well, whatever, the average height in Brazil is 5'8" or something like that." Yeah, but there's 200 million in Brazil, and 2 million are over 6 foot, and they all seem to be playing the national team. When you, they stripped, they were different, you know. And then when you hit you with a tackle, they were different from what I've ever heard before. The weird guys, like Junior, he was a left back. I remember going, right, it was a 50-50. I'll just go and shoulder charge him. And I went, bash. It was like one of these cartoons, you know, you see Tom and Jerry, where you just turn to glass and that was me. I didn't realise that people can be that strong. And even in the tunnel, you know, when it was 110 degrees that day, they had their tops off. You should have seen the physiques on them. And I'm standing beside Bag Alec McLeish. He's got this ginger hairs on his chest and spots everywhere. And I said to Alec, you need to put your strip back on because you look pathetic. So, you know, there were different people at that time compared to us. And it was a less how they didn't win the World Cup. I know why they didn't win the World Cup, because defensively they never really concentrated on it. If they did, they would have won it easily.
Yeah. I mean, poor Jock obviously never got to go to the 86 World Cup.
Yeah.
After that, the tragic death in Wales. And of course, Sir Alex had drafted in as his replacement.
Yeah.
How did you feel about that?
I was fine. We were getting on great at that point. You know, we got over the kind of the hurdles we got over me leaving.
He's not at Man United yet, is he?
He's not at Man United yet. No, so we got over that hurdle and we were talking again and maybe speaking on the phone or seeing each other. So we're fine, and actually kind of talking to each other in the game, but 86 World Cup. But at that time, I'd felt that, you know, 7 years, nearly 7 years with Sir Alex was enough for me, you know, and probably enough for him with me. He doesn't feel it, but he probably had enough for me as well. So it worked out right that I left Aberdeen then. And 86 World Cup, he had the room next to me, and he couldn't sleep at night. So I couldn't sleep because I could hear him through the walls, you know. He had a nervous cough and things like that. And he come out one morning and we're talking football. He said, I'm not sure where to leave out this one. I said, I don't care what you do as long as you pick me. You know, right. And we got in the conversation when he said, because he come to the 85 Cup final. That was in with Man United. There's a guest of mine at night. And he'd been to see, I think it was Arsenal or Tottenham to be their manager the previous day. And I said, so the conversation started again in my room in 86. I said, well, when you got to leave Aberdeen? He said, aye. He says, I might do, but I'm only leaving for two clubs. I said, who's that? He said, Barcelona, Man United. And I went, oh, I hope it's Barcelona, really, I do. So, yeah. But he came to Man United and eventually it worked out really well for him. Yeah. It was hard, but again, his character, seeing him through, people might say Mark Robbins scoring that goal, but his character kept him going. There's not many people would take that and still come back for it. His character and his drive and his anger kept him going.
Because I guess you couldn't get a bigger contrast with the man he replaced, because
Ron.
Big Ron was there, Big Ron
Spoke
Atkinson.
Spoke to him last week. Doesn't he change?
Yeah,
does not change. Still finds it funny. Everything's funny. Talking about footballers. By the way, he had a great knowledge of the game. I mean, great knowledge of the game.
Is he underestimated, Ron? Because, you know, at Manchester United, he won two FA Cups, didn't he? And successive.
Well, even when you
top
go
to
Aston
finishes.
Villa and things like that, yeah. Sheffield Wednesday.
Yeah.
The problem is, and I think that's happened to me a few times, that because I laugh and joke, or try to laugh and joke, people think I don't take the game seriously. I do. I don't take myself seriously. When I walk. And Ron was a bit like that. But Ron turned into a celebrity. He become this giant celebrity I was dealing with. I've never had a celebrity before, is it? I mean, you know, you'd be sitting at night and on your with Leslie and you're watching the telly and Big Ron's there as Frank Sinatra. And he's got to take us training the next again day. Or he might not make it the next again day, knowing Big Ron. But his knowledge of the game was phenomenal. He didn't have that kind of concerted kind of concentration Sir Alex had and Joke had. He felt there was another life out there, which I kind of relate to myself. And so I think that's why people don't take him that seat. But if you actually look at what he does, I think he could have worked a bit more harder and gave us more of his knowledge. I would have loved to have more of his knowledge. But I thought it was great. That's why I followed him to Coventry. And he was a funny, funny fella. But he, as I said, picking players, the right players, getting players, he was great at that. And the game had to be played the right way with him. You know, you talk about Pep and that just now and playing it. Whatever the right way is, I don't know what the fans think the right way is. It's probably fans think, for me as a fan, I want to see shots at goals, I want to see headers, I want to test tackles, I want to see high-tempo football, I want to see goalkeepers saving. That's what Ron wanted. He just wanted attacking football. And the problem was that no matter what you did during the week, it didn't matter to him. Where Sir Alex would have you under lock and key from one game to another, literally, Big Ron would just turn up on Saturday, son, see how it goes, you know. And I found that very strange. I enjoyed it for a bit. I really enjoyed it. But then I probably realised I need a bit more discipline in this because you can get caught up in the madness of football when I was at Man United with the Robsons, White, Sykes, McGrath, Jesus. But he believed that if you turned up and played on a Saturday and played the game, that was all right with him.
Yeah. But I read them. That he didn't brief you on the opposition, didn't he? And you'd have the sort of meal at lunchtime.
You'd have a meal, and with Sir Alex, we'd probably have three meetings previous to big games. But Ron, I was my first game. And I was saying to Brian Robson, when do we do team tactics and things like that? And what? I don't worry about it. So it's just about 12 o'clock. He got him, right, lads? And he opened up his briefcase. I thought, he'll bring out all the notes there. Nope. It was after shaving and put eau de cologne or something like that and just sprayed himself with it. And he literally said, well, they play up front, Barnes, good player, two guys up front, blah, blah. But we've not got a problem. We just win the ball, get into little gags, done the wing, cross it, Robbo, bombing Reds, white side, and you go. And that was it. It was 30 seconds. I thought, oh, okay, fine, that'll do me. And so I found it very strange. But as I said to you, his knowledge of the game was extensive. And you'd be sitting listening to him. It was great. But I would like to have seen him more often. You know, I was seeing him in Spitting Image. He was on Spitting Image, you know. He was playing a piano as Liberace. So I can't imagine Sir Alex playing a piano as Liberace in Spitting Image. But as I said to you, it all just adds to the tapestry of my football world that they're all different. I would hate for them all to be the same.
Yeah. I mean, Ron's methods might have been different, but I mean, you know, and he might have had the sun lamp and the deck chair and the fiber sides.
Yeah, the sun bed in the dressing room, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was unlucky not to win a title, wasn't he, at United? I think, was it 85, 86 when Robbo was injured for half the season?
We started well, we won the first 10 games.
Yeah.
And we're playing fantastically well. There's a couple of reasons. Robbo got injured and I got injured. Just to balance it up properly here, just bring myself in. No, Robbo got injured, who was the magnificent player, the best I've ever played with. But what happened was that the surface wasn't as good in the days. I think if that team had been playing now, or if that surface had been there in their days, I think we'd won the league. But we were a smaller team. If you look at myself, Jasper Olsen, Remy Moses, the fullbacks were kind of small. In their days, you needed a fair bit of height. So the pitches and the height kind of got to us. I think if it had been on lovely surfaces all the way through the season, we would have won the league. That, and if you shut the bars in Manchester and Cheshire, we would have had a chance.
There were one or two who liked a small drink.
Well, there was, if you went down the M56, you turn right into Hale and that, then you could possibly go missing for about 2 days. So I always turn left to go home to Wimslow. So if you went right, we're outside Robson, McGrath, and all these guys. You were disappearing for 4 days off the face of the earth.
Yeah, it's amazing to think what they achieved despite that, isn't it?
But I just think what they could have done without it. Like, yeah. McGrath was Virgil van Dijk of his day. Robson was just magnificent. He could do anything. Whiteside was a genius. But they had this thing about them. You know, there was other ones there as well that they had to enjoy life at the same time. And I think that was the end of the era of that kind of stuff. But it wasn't their fault they got brought up and that's the way you behave as a footballer. Because, as I said, it's different now. And I wouldn't have swapped it for the world because I thought they're just a fantastic group of players.
Still to come on Football's Greatest.
They get paid the big bucks just to make big decisions and deal with the stress that comes with being a manager. If you don't want that stress, go and manage a rotten club and you'll be fine.
The greatest put-down that you ever heard on the pitch or in training?
And I sat there, I got substituted, and he says to me, well, what do you think of the game? I says, well, it's not very good. He says, it's got better since you've come off.
How did you feel when you learned that when Big Ron was going, that Sir Alex was the man who was coming in? What did you say to your teammates?
I says, oh, this is a bit different, gentlemen, because they heard me speaking about him previous. But he started off quite sedate. And after about 6 weeks of boys, I went, no, that's not the guy you describe. I said, just wait. And it did change, yeah. It did change when they got the full brunt of it, because I think Alec was just seeing his way into it. And it was different. It was a different sort of club, different sort of players he was dealing with. They were higher personalities. But I've got to say, the boys never made it difficult for them. They were just who they were. That's who they were. They never went out of their way to make it difficult. Trust me, they were behind them. They found it very strange, the discipline after Big Ron. And obviously, they enjoyed the freedom that Big Ron had given them. It was a wee bit different. But who cares what these boys thought or I thought? He turned that club into this dynasty.
It's going to sound a daft question to anybody who played under Sir Alex, or indeed any media person who met him at the time or had dealings with him. But had he changed? Had he mellowed at all in the years since he started at Aberdeen?
No, he still had that anger. But I think it was perplexing for him to have to deal with these kind of people who were celebrity stars. I think that was a problem. And then he got back again to fully being in control, I think, fully being in control. Not that anybody went out their way to not do it, but it was just different kinds of fully in control when the kids come involved, I think. I think he'd set it through the club with Eric Harris himself what the standards were to be. And it was a long process because everybody explained why you're not successful, why not. As a manager, you can't go, I need to wait till I need to wait. You can't say that. You know, he had to take all the hits and go on with.
Yeah, which he did and did so effectively in the end. But you left. Why did you leave?
I was asked to leave. I was asked to leave, yeah. So I was asked to leave. And to be fair, it was the best thing that ever happened for both of us, to be honest with you. Because I went away and done my thing. I mean, distraught leaving Manchester United. I really was distraught. And the day I was told I had to leave and go and speak to three clubs, it was probably one of the worst days of my life. And then I didn't realise at the time, and that's what happens in life. You make the best of the situation that it's probably one of the best days of my life at the same time. And Leslie and myself made it one of the best days of my life because we had to get on with life then, circumstances, and I had to reevaluate everything about it. I was 32 at the time. Could be finished, could be this. I was told I was getting finished. I was told I passed my best, da, da, da. And I don't regret anybody telling me that because people sometimes then say, oh, well, you proved them wrong. I never gave it a second thought. When people ask questions about you like that, you think, are they right? Are they right? So you ask yourself, and then you have to answer that question, were these people right? And you end up, whatever, I played another 5-6 years at Leeds United, and at the end of it, or during it, you never go, I was right, me, I could still play. You live in the glow of that moment of enjoying yourself. I've never, ever, no matter what everybody said with me, think, right, I'll show you. It's different if they speak about my kids. Well, different as far, you say something about my kid, I'm coming for you, and I'll no like you forever, you know. But it's about me, I'm fine with it. It's only people asking questions, and you've got to answer their questions to yourself, really. To yourself.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, this is Leeds now. We're a championship side. You win the championship. Yeah. I was wondering, you know, see, Howard Wilkinson, I've always thought Howard, you know, mild-mannered, easygoing, relatively easygoing anyway. Mm. We've had one or two run-ins in the past, but...
Yes.
But how did he handle that group of players? Because there were some big characters again there, weren't there? Obviously, Vinnie Jones was there at the time. Eric Cantona was there.
He came a bit later, Eric, the second. But and the when he first got there, he had to clear it a lot. I mean, a lot. I mean, seriously. And it's brutal in their days. If you're not wanted, he'd have nearly 8 or 10 players sitting at the side watching us training. But he had to do something drastic because the club was just floating about going nowhere. And he gave us each... Your mate, Cammy, was there.
Cammy was there, that's right.
Vinny, myself, and there was a couple of young boys coming through, David Batty, Gary Speednight. And I've got to say, probably, it's the most satisfying season of my career was that in the Championship, not one in the Premier, or whatever you call it. It was that, because I worked with some, as I say to these guys, they took me to another level in terms of influence. The Cammies and Vinnie Jones and Andy Williams and people that were there at the time, Mel Stirling, Peter Haddock. There's names that probably some of you guys don't. But they made a huge difference to my life. And the fact that I become a captain again, and when I used to go to clubs, they just go, sign that contract and we'll see where we go. But when I went to Leeds, it was like, sign the contract, but I'll tell you what, we need to in 2 years get out of here because the club's in trouble. I mean, really trouble. So that was the first time, and the real responsibility being thrown on me as a person. I have to do this properly. I moved house. I could have travelled, but I moved house, did everything right to get over there and do everything right. And as I say, when I done it, I bumped into some of the best teammates I've ever worked with. Some of the best, your man, your Tommy Cammy and Vinnie Jones and people like that, who were just unbelievable characters. And we didn't have fitness coaching these days. Vinnie Jones, Cammy, myself, would set the standards for trainers. A boy called Dylan Kerr, Imre Varadi, Gary Speed, they would take the and drag the group along. As I said, and I they're the best teammates, some of the best teammates, not the best players I've ever worked with, that's for sure, but some of the best teammates, Cammy, Vinny. And what I know about the characters, as you know, Vinny's went on to films, music, whatever you think, yeah, I think he's a great fella, but been successful, you know, because they had that inbuilt character, no matter what they're doing, they drive themselves on and they want to be good teammates. And what they do is they drag other people along with them. Cammy was the same, super fit, great character. I was so glad he joined Leeds because every time I played against it, he got on my flimmin' nerves. He never shut up. I mean, he literally spoke through the whole game at you. I know where you're going. I know what I'm doing. I'm coming to get you.
Well, he's like that in life, Gordon, isn't he?
But that's why we love him. And so when he joined us, he was great. He was a great foil for me. And again in life, because his character and his drive, he goes and becomes a presenter, does this, he's singing. Both of them made albums, Vinnie Jones and Chris Kamara.
You'd have got long odds against that, wouldn't you?
Seriously.
When's yours coming out, Gordon?
Oh, it must be better than they two, for goodness sake. You stick a big band behind me, I must be half decent.
Did you believe it was possible you'd go on and win the first division title?
No chance. Absolutely no chance, because I thought when we won that, that's fine. That'll do me. I can pack in football now because I was only asked to do that. And then Howard, how clever he is, he just went, right, I need to scrap that and we need to do something else. So unfortunately, Vinny, Cammy and people like that, they moved on. But they moved on to be success elsewhere. And he brought on a more refined Rod Wallace, Tony D'Arrigo, people like that, Gary McAllister, a more refined team. And that's how clever Howard was. He could have, I think it had been me as a manager. I thought, oh, I like these guys. I better keep them to give them a shot at the top league. We just went, no, bang. And that's what the good managers can do. So I like that when you find that a player at Man United is no longer of any use or he can be a problem. Just see you, bang. Maybe that's one of my faults. I was so loyal to a lot of players. But again, when they've changed it, that's me.
You mentioned it there. I mean, you got your first managerial chance at Coventry. You've gone there though, not as the manager, but as assistant manager, hadn't you? But still playing.
Funny enough, one of the best parts of my life was when I stopped at Leeds And it's it was a wonderful way to go. I played at Liverpool. I played Liverpool 44,000 at home. And I was no influence at all in the game. And Howard says, can I meet you on the Monday? So we went on Monday and we looked at each other and went, what do you think? And I went, well, he says, well, I think we need to change this. I went, yeah, okay. And then I've just got to retire then. Come on the coaching staff, okay. So I went to the coaching staff and I coached the reserve team. But I had a wonderful time. As I said, football's just wonderful. I had a wonderful time. I coached them, but I played with them, the reserve team, at Halifax on a Tuesday night and snow and weather. But I've got to say, it was just magical working with these, because you work with them, taught them things, and then learned them to be characters, playing, demanding with them. So I did that for about 4 months. And it was great. And then Ron called, said, would you like to come and be the assistant manager? With the proviso, when I pack in, you get the manager's job. Brian Richard agreed with that. But it was a con, really. He wanted me to go along there and start playing again. Because as soon as I got there, well, listen, you really should be. I'm not what to play. I've had enough. No, you need to be playing. Da-da-da. So I started playing again. And we managed to stay up. It was a relegation thing. So I started. But it was hard work. It was hard work being the player coach and all the rest of it, yeah.
You're still playing in the top division at 40 years of age.
40, yeah, I was playing manager, yeah.
You must, I mean, looking back, that must make you so proud.
It was. And I never changed. The way my last couple of games, fitness levels when they back, it was just getting myself up to date again and deal with the stress and the whole lot. And I as a player manager, I was falling asleep in my dressing room. In my office. I was snoring away the day before a game because there was so much to be done. Then I'd play the game. And that was strange because you've got to be the manager. There's a captain on the pitch. There's an assistant manager over there doing things. So that was really strange to do that because they're getting conflicting. Like Paul Telfer's a wing back. And I was asking when I'm playing against Chelsea, I'm in midfield against all these top players. And Arsenal was playing against Petit and Vieira and all that. And Paul Telfer, I said, could you come and give us a hand over that? He said, no, Alec Miller, he's telling me to stay back. I'm the manager. I'm 40-year-old. I'm now tiring. Get yourself up there. And the gaffer says, right, okay. And he's up there. So it was really strange to try and, even at half time, to kind of switch off and sit there and then say something. Lucky enough, I had two experienced people like Gary Pendry and Alec Miller at the time who were doing it. But it really was stressful. It was stressful doing that. So when I finished football, when I said, that's enough for me, and I was 40, because the last few games was Arsenal, Chelsea, Tottenham, Derby, Liverpool, and we win at Liverpool. We drew with Arsenal, beat Chelsea, and beat Spurs in the last game of the season to stay up. So it was memorable, but it was a fitting way to say that's enough of this, you know, that's enough of this. But I couldn't have got any more out myself, that's for sure.
As the years went on and you weren't playing, you were just managing, did it become any less stressful?
No. Because the media thing started to grow as well, which made it more stressful for managers. Years ago, you got a couple of guys come to speak to you, but Sky turned it into this wonderful package we've got just now. I mean, seriously wonderful package. But with that, the questions become more intrusive. Your lifestyle becomes more intrusive. The psychologist speaking about you and they don't even know you have an opinion. So that is a stressful part of being a manager now. Because when I was at Celtic, I really paid well. And I suppose the same way people at Liverpool, Man City, they really don't get paid for coaching. That's a wonderful part of it. You date for nothing, I date for nothing. They get paid the big bucks is to make big decisions and deal with the stress that comes with being a manager. If you don't want that stress, go and manage a rotten club and you'll be fine. But if you want, so that's what you really get paid for now, is to deal with the stress that comes with the intrusion into your lifestyle. And even when club has a wee wobbler, it's everybody's on board. He's got this, that. Guardiola has one day where he's, right, okay, his psyche is this, that, and everything. And they're lucky because it only happens to them once every 20 games. But for the people in the middle of the league, it's happening a lot, and it's harder to keep your composure when it's firing at you all the time. So I was saying to somebody, when I had to apologise to, I think it was a reporter or an assistant manager. I wrote him a letter saying, at times that, you know, when you get in that newsroom, it's one against 50. And it's like a tag team. They'll tag it over to the next one. You ask them that question. They build it up. They know what's coming. So it's one against 50. You actually feel sometimes as a manager like that, like a wounded animal and somebody's prodding you with a stick. I found that difficult. And there's points where I handled it quite well. And there's points where I look back and go, ooh. And it was, you know, I could always apologise when I knew I was wrong. I was quite good at apologising. I had to get used to it, to be honest with you. I found it got more stressful.
But you've been in a couple of the toughest managerial jobs possible, especially for a Scot, with all due respect, manager of Celtic. Now that is one tough job.
I think if you can manage Celtic or Rangers and come out sane at the end of it, then you can go and manage anybody in the world, because that is where there is real stress, because not only is football in there, there's another mad world that goes on in the west of Scotland that you have to deal with. And to keep saying on that, lucky I've got a sense of humour, and I also protected myself out there when I was at Celtic. I never read anything, I never listened to anything, I never watched anything to do with me or football. And people thought that was arrogant, but I felt it was the only way I could speak to people on a level playing field if I didn't listen to what they had said, because I think if I'd listened to what some had said, I'd be going in there gunning for them. I said to the press people, only tell me if it's lies, the rest of it keep to yourself, so I could deal with that. And then, so it didn't affect me on the training field either, because I've seen affecting managers.
But what was your life like in general there? Because you must have been under so much scrutiny.
I never went
all
out.
The time.
No. Because Glasgow is a different world altogether. But at the time, you know, most places you go, Southampton, how you doing, Gordon? All right, it's Glasgow. Hey, come here, I want to speak to you, wee man. No, they said, why are you playing that? This one and this one's crap and that one. So I got a hold of you. So I never really went out. I decided that we've just got to live in a bubble. Occasionally went out for a walk along with another flat in the West End. And I went out with Leslie one night. I had a big jacket with a hood on. And she's walking, she's still dressed from the game on the Saturday. And this was about 9:30 at night. And I'm walking just to get a bit of fresh air. And this guy's walking up to us. And this is going to happen in Glasgow. And he's watching us and he's smiling at Leslie. And of course, Leslie's at your gym. And he's not looking at me. And I thought, usually they speak at me. So he's come up and stood right in front of us. And he went, all right. And I thought, he's got to speak to Leslie. And Leslie went, yeah. What are you doing next week? And I thought, you speak to me. I said, and I'm speaking to your partner. I said, and he said, if you've got nothing to do, I'll take you out. I went, really? Am I standing here? And Leslie went, right, and then as he's walked away and he shouted back, by the way, I'm far better looking than him. What are you doing going out with him? And I went, right. And that's what happens in Glasgow. And you go, all right, okay. I was just feeling good about myself. Now somebody's wanting to take my wife off me. And you couldn't, it wasn't worth it going out because you could get involved in something. But I've got to say, when I did go out, people were great. And that's what I'm talking about this, we were talking about the internet, when people saying the fans are saying this. Wherever I went, people in general were absolutely fantastic, but I was scared in case I got involved in anything.
Yeah.
But that's, as I'm saying, that's the problem with being a modern day manager. Your whole life's ripped apart in front of your eyes and people don't even know you. And it's not just with the internet, by the way. It's the media outlets who play on the internet and they join in. Don't worry about that. Yeah. Oh, it's internet, but you join in, make it worse.
I do hope you're enjoying the show. I just want to tell you that you can follow us at Football's Greatest Pod on Instagram, TikTok and Facebook. And search for Football's Greatest Pod to find us on X. Obviously, you had your spell as Scotland manager as well.
I loved that.
Yeah.
Absolutely loved that.
Even though it must have been frustrating in some ways, though, because, you know, you played for great Scottish teams.
Yeah.
Great players and things. But your choice was more restricted, wasn't it?
Somebody said to me that, would you go back into management? I said, yes, if I could take that group with me. I loved them. I thought they were great lads. And the good thing about that is, being an international manager, you don't get the problems. They come 99% of the time, they're feeling good about themselves, legs good, the form's good, they're good. So you don't have to deal with the nonsense that can sometimes happen in an everyday run in a professional club. And then if you bring a player along, they don't suit the system, they don't suit the dressing room, you just go, you don't invite them again. And then you invent things like, they don't suit the system, da-da-da. Just didn't like them. They didn't fit in. But when you've got somebody who's hanging about at a club and he's got a four-year contract and he's driving you bonkers, that's stressful. But the Scottish job was, it just suited me fine. And the fact that you can make a nation incredibly happy is a wonderful thing. There's a glow to it. We're a point away or something like that from getting there, but circumstances never got us there. So that's a disappointing thing about it, but I wouldn't have changed it for the world. I thought we'd have a great bunch to work with. Mm. Really good bunch.
What sort of job do you feel Steve Clark's doing? He's got a brilliant sense of humour for a start.
Yeah, Steve just stays the same all the way through. I used what I had at the time, and mine's were kind of wide men. They were the most important things. Steve's not had that, the strikers. But Scotland's never had strikers for ages, to be honest with you. Real out-and-out strikers. Because I keep looking back saying, if Scotland had Lewandowski, we'd been qualified for another four. If we had Gareth Bale, we would have qualified. There's absolutely no doubt about it. If you can have that genius in your team, then you can help. Everything we had today was as a team. Everything we had to achieve was as a team. But I think he's got it right, Steve. What he's done is, I'm making it difficult to beat me. And my goal scorers are midfield players, McGinn and McTominay, and the rest will back you up. Set plays, hard to beat. I think he's used his squad that he's got wisely. He's used the fact that he's got height and strength in there now. Where I was a bit kind of looking for the perfect football with wide men stepping in and Maloney's and that. And I hope to get through playing the perfect football. Sometimes we've seen it, and sometimes we're up against it. Mm. I loved it. I really loved it. And it was a real disappointment not to continue, actually.
Are you done in management? Could you ever be tempted back?
No, I don't have the anger anymore. So if you don't get the anger, don't. I know far more than I did when I left the Scotland job. Know far more. But they have the anger and drive to put into practice every day? No. Day when I go to Dundee, where I work as a coordinator, do I want to work with the development squad and go and watch the academy and speak to the coaches, like, think about this, think about that? I can do that. It's lovely. And I get on the training field every now and then with the younger, the development squad coaches, and they're the kids between about 17 and 20. And I love working with them. And we throw ideas together. But I know far more about the game now than even with the Scotland thing. But I just don't have the drive. And you need that anger and drive. I've not got that anymore. Life's too... at the moment, I think life and deserves to be enjoyed. Somebody was saying yesterday, what are you doing? I said, I'm really busy, but I'm busy doing things that I want to do. I'm here because I want to do it. Not because I have to do it. It's here because I want to do it, because I enjoy talking football and meeting people.
So, Gordon, I've got 10 questions or so for you. I'm going to ask you some great people on moments from your career.
All right.
Okay. Greatest manager or coach, and why?
Him.
Needs no more than that. Yeah. Greatest teammate?
Teammates are different from the greatest football players. So I got Kamara, Paul Telfer, Vinnie Jones, Peter Haddock, Alec Caldwell, all them. Just great teammates.
Your greatest goal?
Against Leicester, Leeds versus Leicester. Most important goal.
Was it?
Yeah.
You were a winner?
It was a winner. You never seen it, Jeff?
Yeah, probably.
Get yourself on YouTube. You'll love it. It was a left foot. It was the one that literally got us promotion.
Brilliant. Oh,
yeah.
Fantastic.
Matter of fact, it's the only piece of memorabilia I've got in my house.
Is it?
It's not hanging up at the moment. It's a painting somebody did it of celebration. It's only a bit of memorabilia.
Only a bit of memorabilia. Why not more?
Because I had kids who wanted to play football, and there was no way was I sticking my stuff up there to make it even harder for them to be in the football world.
Yeah, interesting. Who's the fastest player played against?
There's a boy called Willie Johnston. Played for Rangers. I pulled my hamstring chasing him because he annoyed me. He went by me and went, beep, beep. And I chased after him. I thought, I'm going to boot you. But halfway there, I tore my hamstring.
Greatest rollicking you ever received, I'm
guessing. Yes, it's him again. Yeah,
him again.
There's loads of them.
Greatest.
I can give him a top 100 if you want.
Greatest regret?
None.
Toughest guy that you played with or against?
There was one that, who I spoke about years ago in Scotland. Was a guy called Peter Dixon, but Peter's had his shot. But there was two I was scared though. But no scared though. Drew Busby I was scared though. He played for Morton Hearts, and he was really aggressive, and he could have done damage to you. He was actually a good footballer. But I elbowed him in the face and burst his nose one day, and it was self-protection. This guy was solid, and this was about 15 minutes, and I basically kept away from him. Then at the end of the game, he heard him running across and thought he's going to smack me, and he shook my hand and went, "Well done, that's me, I like it." I went, "Oh, thank Christ for that." But Stuart Pearce was one. It was just too hard for me to handle. I invented playing between the lines. Right, so I actually said, "You get yourself on the touchline, get against him, take him on." I know for a fact I can't take him on. He's too big, he's too strong. I'll go and play in here. So I've invented playing between the lines. I was 20 years ahead of everybody.
But it's self-preservation.
Exactly. So he'd have to come and find me rather than put myself a self-sacrifice out there. You come and find me if you want to kick me.
The greatest put down that you ever heard sort of on the pitch or in training?
I think it was me, as what you call Harry Davis at Dundee. When I come off as a kid about 17, 16, and I sat there, I got substituted, and he said to me, "What do you think of the game?" I says, "Oh, it's no very good." He says, "It's got better since you've come off." So, fine. Kind of stung that.
Greatest dressing room joker?
I don't know. We worked in packs. There was anybody who was... you know, I don't go for this cutting up shoes and all that, nailing things. I don't think that's humour. That's just stupid. That's lack of intelligence. But I think if you got caught in packs like Sterling, Marcel, Cammy, these people in there, there's a group that this humour come from. It was the same at Aberdeen with McLeish, Stuart Kennedy, myself, Mark McGee. All kind of, it all come from there and everybody joined in. So it wasn't a single guy being a clown. It was always, there was a kind of nucleus of a group that could be funny and spread that humour about.
And I think you've told all the stories, but I'm going to ask you, have you got a story that you've never told before?
I was just thinking about the other day when I seen a guy called Harry Roberts, who used to play for Coventry Wolves, and he worked with me at Coventry. And we went, Big Ron took us when I first got there. I've no idea why we went to Tenerife in February, right? I've got an idea why we went there. Big Ron's got a house there. So we went out and he left us, and the players went one way, and I went with Mick Brown, who's assistant manager with Ron at Coventry and Man United, and Harry. And the players went one way. So I was a player coach thing. So I went with them. And anyway, I went for a drink, and I ended up being second in a lookalike competition. And I was second being me. And the woman who won it was a lookalike for Vera Duckworth, who looked nothing like Vera Duckworth. So I had to go up and get presented with a bottle of wine for coming second for looking like me. In a bar in Tenerife. So that was it, probably. It was the funniest. Because Harry went, "I'll put you in." What was that? "Oh, we've got a golden strike and lookalike over here." So I did stand up with a Vera Duckworth. I can't remember who it was, Charlie Drake or something like that. And I had to stand there and I had to become second being myself. And I got a bottle of wine.
That's Tenerife for you. We've reached the end of Football's Greatest. My thanks to Gordon Strachan for joining us today. Next time on Football's Greatest, we're going back to the 80s as Charlie Nicholas names his top five British players of that era.
It was a testimonial for Ozzy Ardiles, and Maradona came over from Italy because he played an Argentinian World Cup with Ardiles. And after 20 minutes, Maradona ignored everybody. Just kept out of the way, and just kept pointing at Hoddle and saying to Ardiles, "Give the ball to Hoddle, just give the ball." Because Maradona knew wherever he moved, Hoddle could find him. He was the best player in the world by a distance at that time, and Hoddle lit his night up.
Remember to subscribe to the show on YouTube and follow us on your favourite podcast platform. Football's Greatest is a Folding Pocket production with BBC Studios.